accession number 18822, reel 4.
George Aitchison, reel 4.
But before his big attack, Mutaguchi needed a firm base on the Leta range, which was the main mountain ridge running north and south. It was 22 miles from his 52 miles from his divisional headquarters at Kalewa, and 22 miles on towards Tidim, and in turn 160 miles towards Imphal. And that he was going to use his crack 33rd White Tiger Division for that attack. And he would neutralize us by putting roadblocks up at suitable points, and there were many suitable points through the mountainous country between us and Imphal. And since we were to a large extent dependent on jeeps and three-ton lorries for supplies, this would be crippling. And then if we broke up into small groups and worked our way through the mountainous jungle back to Imphal, he could harry those small groups, and it would take us a long time to get together and be effective in Imphal. But before he made this big push, he needed a firm base at 8,000 feet on the Leta range. And there was a very good position just 22 miles south of Tidim, where the ridge broadened out. The ridge was a bit like Striding Edge and Helvellyn, occasionally knife edge, occasionally broadening out. And there was a very nice position which would do very well as a firm base to supply a complete brigade. And somebody in Corps or Div headquarters thought that we were a bit thin on the ground for that kind of big country, so they sent up the 1st 16th Punjab. And the 1st 16th Punjab chose the very spot which Mutaguchi wanted to form a defensive position. And the 1st 16th Punjab came through our lines, and at the time I was on Kennedy Peak, which was 6 miles from this position, which we eventually by common consent called Milestone 52, although in fact, because it was 52 miles from Jap Div HQ, and there was a Burma Highway Department stone saying it was a figure 52 on it, so as even the Gurkhas could understand that, we called it 52 for convenience. But the signalers and the sappers called it Milestone 22, because that was the distance forward from our division headquarters at Tidim. And the Japs called it 0.8198, because there was a spot height on the map just there, 8,198 feet. Anyway, it was a position which everybody coveted. It had roads leading to and from, ridges where you could get patrols down fairly comfortably, and it had broadened out sufficient to take at least a battalion, and water was available lower down, not too far away, at a place called Fort White. Although Fort White had been built in 1889 in order to pacify the people of the Chin Hills, who at the time were not keen on joining the British Empire. The fort had just disintegrated, but there was still a rather scruffy bungalow and a water supply. So anybody on Milestone 52 was doing very nicely. Water available, room to build a good division, and plenty of space for supplies.
1 month have we reached now, by the way?
October 43. I was, at the time, with a rifle company on what was called Kennedy Peak. That was the highest point of all, 8,871 feet, 6 miles from Milestone 52. And I kept myself fit by visiting outlying platoons. I'd have to drop down 5,000 feet, climb up 4,000 feet, and then do the same coming back. And that was a good day's exercise. And it kept me in touch with my outlying platoons. By then I'd been transferred to B Company, Rifle Company, had this little sector across the main ridge with outlying platoons, but the country was so large, 5, 9, literally it would take me 18,000 feet to visit a platoon.
So you were in charge of the company?
Yes. One day I thought the 16th Punjabis had time to get themselves organised. I'll go and see them. So I trudged 6 miles along the ridge to their position, and there didn't seem to be a proper perimeter, and I wandered into their lines, and there were a couple of sentries standing up looking mournfully, as though they didn't particularly like being posted to this kind of country. I think they were Punjabi Muslims. But they were every Jap from Harka to Falam could have seen those sentries. And then an orderly called up the colonel, and he was a short, stout little chap, but very light on his feet, like some plump girls are good dancers. And he had beautifully polished, excellent quality brown chaplis and beautifully starched shorts. And we asked a few desultory questions. I didn't feel I was very welcome. And he said, "I hope you don't think I'm a shit, but may I see your identity card?" So I thought, crumbs, do I really look like a Jap? Anyway, I had, fortunately, my identity card and showed him. And to justify my intrusion into his territory, I tried to say that every day his supplies came through my company 6 miles away, and was there anything I could do to help? And they wheeled up the quartermaster, who was a busy little chap. It seems that if any decision was taken, the quartermaster actually saw that it was carried out. He seemed to outrank the adjutant, which surprised me. And the there was a little hollow, and the adjutants, the four rifle company commanders, were drinking tea, and they didn't offer me any, and I was dying to ask them questions like, how have you what material have you covered your bunkers and slit trenches? How far in front of your defensive positions do you put your wire? We keep ours well in, less than 10 yards, because if it was any further out, we find the Japs have the field craft to get through the wire and get in inside our perimeter. And it was full of a whole series of questions like that. So they're down there, but it would, but I didn't in the event say anything, because I felt they were looking at me as though fucking Gurkha spy come to see how we are, and they were spread out like a amorphous transit camp, with no proper perimeter, and there was just a touch of luxury. All their leather was beautifully polished, chaplets, and having been on the North's front, of course, they wore chaplets rather than boots. I thought that unsound. In the end, you need the firmness of boots in that kind of country. It wouldn't have surprised me that somewhere in one of their yakdans you'd find a bottle of champagne and a couple of tins of oysters or something of that quality.
In one of the what?
A yakdan is something, £56 weight, and you fill it up to £66 and put one each side of a mule. It's a kind of container. I suddenly felt that they looked upon me as a kind of spy who would report back. I don't know. Anyway, I suddenly saw myself as they saw me. I hadn't had a haircut for 5 months. I had shaved, but I hadn't had a bath for 2 months. At that time, you had to go down nearly 4,000 feet to get any water. But, of course, they had the water from the old Fort White position. And so I was hirsute, unshaven, and I had, as bad luck would have it, a dreadful uniform. The Gurkhas had all got uniforms their size, and to get a uniform my size, I was given something that was far too big at the waist, and all I had managed to do was to tie it round with an old pyjama cord across two bandoliers of ammunition. And my webbing, although it had two fully loaded 30 rounds each rounds of brand magazines and three grenades and anything else I might need, webbing hadn't been blankoed for months. And I suddenly realised that I looked just kind of shaggy, undesirable sort of chap. So I said, I was glad to hear that everything was going smoothly. I saluted and trudged 6 miles back to Kennedy Peak. I think we can stop there. I carried on at Kennedy Peak. Meanwhile, the whole of the rest of my battalion joined me and chose Kennedy Peak as a big defensive battalion position. And then a fortnight later, General Mutaguchi's intentions were disclosed in a very startling manner. About 3 a.m. on the 13th of November, we were woken by the most terrific mortar and machine gun barrage from Milestone 52. The crack 215 regiment of Mutaguchi's 33rd Division made a furious and suicidal attack on the 1st 16th Punjab. There were a lot of casualties. The colonel and four officers were among those killed. That was the colonel who wore the highly polished chaplets and and asked me for my identity card. Sorry, am I not making sense?
Yes, you certainly are.
I see. And the entire battalion was scattered. Next morning, a bedraggled lot came through our lines, unshaven, dirty, shirts flapping outside their trousers, motley footwear, plimsolls, chupleys, blistered feet in boots without socks. Some were unarmed. Many of the Sikhs had lost their pagris. Copious hair was tied up in a funny little knot. It was a defeated battalion. Dejected, fatigue, resentment, bewilderment in every move. However, many years later, Louis Allen found a diary by one Lieutenant Nakamura, who was in the attack, and said that the 1st 16th had fought much harder than they expected, because the position they had occupied was, in defensive terms, such a shambles, the Japs had expected a walkover. But the Japs had quite a number of casualties. Some of these were inflicted by a company of the 1st, 3rd Gurkhas that were sent along the crest as soon after the first noise reached us. And such is the confusion of battle, they got really quite close and charged forward, doing an action which we called a blitz. That is, every single man with whatever he'd got, a rifle section would have a Bren gun, two Tommy guns, and six riflemen, and so on all the way up. And they simply went straight forward in a line, firing with everything they had got, straight into, without even taking an aim, just firing straight ahead of them. And amongst other things, they killed a rather obese Japanese officer, whom the Gurkhas insisted on calling Likita, although there was no reason why. He really was a doctor. But for some reason, the Gurkhas all remembered that occasion when they shot up the 215 White Tiger Regiment and killed the Likita doctor.
Likita is Gurkhali, is it?
Yes, doctor. But the Japs had the ridge ranged to a yard with their 81mm mortars, and they plunked down as many rounds as they could, and the Gurkha Rifle Company came to a stop with quite heavy casualties, and their company commander, I think his name was Smith, had one leg blown off. He survived, but of course he anyway, they got back. The survivors of the Gurkhas got back along the ridge to their original position near us on Kennedy Peak. But the Punjabis were held up by a very determined Jap contingent on the top of the ridge that forced the Punjabis to go around on the east side of the mountain range, which was terrible because the east side caught the monsoon and was thickly grown up right to the top with jungle. And there were so many little nullahs and other difficulties, that we reckoned it would take an hour to do a half a mile by daylight. Well, they had 6 miles to go, and they began to reach us mid-morning. That jungle was country was so difficult on the east side of the range that later one of our company commanders had his wristwatch just torn from his wrist by the roughness of the jungle, and it was never found. The second in command of the 1st 16th Punjab was one of the survivors, and he went up to make his number with our acting brigadier, and Guy Burton, our acting brigadier, had done really rather well. He'd got a DSO serving with the 10th Gurkhas in the first big retreat, and had reached the rank of acting brigadier, but the second in command of the 16th Punjab Hood had actually been in the same year at Sandhurst with him, same course. He took one look at Guy Burton, who was looking excited and pleased himself, as he always did. And that second in command had the exhausted and resentful air of someone who'd done a very difficult and tedious and uncomfortable journey to a bad posting that he didn't want. And he looked up at Guy Burton and said, "Oh, hello, Guy." And then they were all moved on by DVHQ. I never knew what happened to them. Presumably taken back to Tidham, put into temporary accommodation, fed, sent back somewhere.
And you were present at the time?
Oh, yes. They came through my lines. That's why I could see them with them, the Sikhs with their pugris off and fans and knots and their rather unsatisfactory motley footwear, and wearing the clothing that they happened to have on at 3 o'clock in the morning, which could, you know, could be anything. Then, for some ridiculous reason, we didn't counterattack the lost position that was Milestone 52 for 30 days. I think the first third Gurkhas had a go, but found it quite impossible. And it was decided that on the, I think, the 12th December 1943, two whole battalions, the first third and the first fourth Gurkhas, would leave Candy Peak at 0001 hours, that's 12th December, march the 6 miles to the Japanese position. The 129 Edinburgh Territorial Field Company of Artillery would lay down a creeping barrage, and we'd pick that up. Things went wrong. The creeping barrage expended itself on nothing at all, because, as I found about an hour later, the Japs had contracted into a small, superbly built defensive position, which was like a, in comparison with the 16th Punjab treatment of the same ground, it was as though it was like a Fabergé gem, a nicely cut gem by Fabergé, as against a run-of-the-mill landscape by Sir Alfred Munnings, you know. There was no point in having a creeping barrage, because the Japs simply had nobody there. They were all inside this small but beautifully constructive defensive position, and by the time the creeping barrage lifted to enable us to attack, the shells had not hit a single Japanese. Perhaps in the final in the final bit of the creeping barrage, they might have hit the Jap defences, but the Japs had bunkerized themselves impregnably. That might give you an idea.
This is a photograph you're giving me entitled "The Japanese Bunker on the
Lofire Ridge." You've got it in the IWM, actually. That's just a photocopy, not very good. The two battalions side by side, the third Gurkhas on the left, and the fourth Gurkhas, that's me, on the right, and the leading company of the first Gurkhas found that the last 50 yards before the Japanese position had been cleared of all jungle, and ahead of them was a formidable barbed wire obstacle, 5 foot high and 4 feet across, and the jungle the Japs had cleared was thrust all over it, so that you couldn't see the other side. And the leading third Gurkha company went up and began to scramble over the wire, and the company commander was killed, and every man with him was hit. And the colonel, trying to keep the momentum going, he too scrambled up the barbed wire, and he in turn was immediately killed, and everybody with him was hit. So our colonel said, "We'll go right." Now, there was no jungle on the right. You could go up clearly, and there was a little crest. And he shouted to me that Keble was commanding C Company. I was to join Keble in case he was hit, and take over and do as best I could with C Company. And we went up the slope, and I saw, to my horror, that the line of barbed wire, 5 foot high and 4 foot across, was firmly held in the ground by big wooden stakes. It was an insuperable problem, and then it seemed that every medium machine gun in the world opened fire on converging lines, and Keble was hit, but he moved forward determinedly to the wire, and he was hit twice more, and a couple of riflemen dragged him by his shoulders downhill to safety, but he died of wounds. And the colonel had already, on a recce, been wounded, but his binoculars had taken the worst of the wound, and he had an uncomfortable but not lethal wound. And then he too